Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fides Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news from the past month. This is episode number 47 for May 2012. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fides Club. My name is Patrick Beja, and this is the show where we get people from different parts of the world to gather around once a month and give you their take on what's been happening in the past month. So you hopefully get a different view on the world events every time and maybe get to experience something new and wonderful and delightful. That's usually what happens. I can't guarantee it's going to happen this month. I'm in the basement of my parents' house in the French countryside, and we might get interrupted by screaming baby nieces and possibly my terrible cough. I was going to say cow. I understand that Maria, who's there with us too, is not in the best shape she's ever been because she's pregnant again.
Hey, don't hold that against me.
How's the second pregnancy doing?
I'm wonderful. I actually don't have any problems with this pregnancy. I just have been working a bit much lately. I've just started a new job at the emergency room, so I have long and late shifts.
See, there you go. The Swedish for you. They get pregnant and they still go working on, you know, long and late shifts, and that's equality for you there. Very impressive. I'm checking my mic levels. I'm a little bit concerned that I'm not on the right one. Am I sounding good to you guys, or am I on the outside mic?
That's so subjective.
Well, from a podcasting professional such as you, Randy, was expecting something a little bit more constructive. No, I should be on the right one. I'm using the wonderful, $20 Apple mics, which surprisingly work pretty well. Here's a little podcasting tip for you guys out there. If you don't have a mic, just use your iPhone and Skype, and it works. Randy is also here on the show with us. He was actually here an hour early because apparently...
That's right.
What is it? 4 years of doing podcasts with me is not enough to understand how time zones work.
The United States keeps shifting. You know, every 6 months we decide we're going to just change the clocks.
Well, that's what we do too. So we're actually always on the same.
You do it at different times.
Yeah, there's like a 2 week lag where, you know, just to annoy everyone, we don't do it at the same time. Yeah. So see, you came early, and I'm managing to find a way to hold it against you. I'm really good. So you woke up super early, and so thank you for that. You're, as people probably already know, in the U.S., in California.
Yes.
And the wonderful voice that you heard a second ago is that of Kerwin,
who's Hello
also
again.
There with us, and who has a new mic. Yay
yes.
for Kerwin's new mic.
He's a lot of new everything, actually.
Really?
A new laptop as well, I believe, since the last time.
Amazing. And a new, how can we call it, life schedule for the coming year, as I understand it.
That's true. I'm going to be podcasting from a lot of very interesting places the next few months.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about it before we get into the show? Or?
I can. It's 10 weeks in Lagos. 10 weeks in Accra, and 10 weeks in Dakar.
So
that should take me to about Christmas.
What are you going to be doing there?
interviewing businessmen.
It sounds a lot less adventurous all of a sudden.
When the phrase Nigerian businessman means something very specific to internet denizens, so I'm fascinated now.
It means something very specific to Nigerians as well. I think they're all.
Please elaborate.
Nigeria has a reputation for internet scams that involve antique princes who have large billions.
That's what we meant. I said
Randy's
bank accounts.
Oh, you didn't realize that? That's what Randy was referencing, Maria?
No.
Oh, it's the pregnancy. It doesn't. It's okay. It will.
Come on. You're supposed to be a feminist, Patrick.
Yes, I'm giving you crap because I know that you know I'm a feminist. All right. So, Kerwin, you're hopefully going to be able to join us for all those from all those exotic locations in the future.
As long as I have power.
You mean like electric power? Not
that's
like,
right.
Okay.
Not all power right. to. Hot seas.
That would be, you know, if you have that power, you definitely have to join us because I want to hear about that. All right, so I'm not the as I was saying, I'm not in super duper shape, but it's been a very busy month for me, probably for Randy as well. So I don't know how accurate we are going to be on all the stories, but you know, we're still
That's
going to try.
Never stopped
and...
us before.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Thank you. And hopefully we will have fun in the process. So for me, the main story of the month was obviously the French election, which we've talked a little bit about last month. And I think we can talk about it again, but maybe more briefly. And see what happened in your countries if you're terrified at the arrival of the new socialist French president. I'm guessing Sweden doesn't mind all that much, but as expected, basically the socialist candidate François Hollande won the election, and it was a clear win. Sarkozy made a very dignified speech right after the election ended. That was in the beginning of the month, I think, the 6th. And so he's taken power around the middle of the month, and he started... there were a couple of funny stories, things like he took a jet to get to Paris, and there was a lot of... reproach to Sarkozy because he was spending too much money or being too extravagant on some things. So a lot of people noticed that Hollande took a jet and no one said anything. I guess a few people did. So then he took a train to go to Brussels for a summit. And then the train wasn't available when he came back, so he took a series of cars. And there was another small controversy because they actually had to close down the whole train so that he could take it, so it didn't cost less or pollute less than a jet. A couple of it's still in the funny stages at this point. he nominated his first government. The government, he respected the equality of men and women. He got a few very young people in there, young women also. And he reduced the salary of himself and all the ministers by 30%. He has more ministers than previous administrations, so it doesn't, you know, it's still symbolically, it's a good thing. I mean, overall, it's interesting because I think I believe I talked about the adversarial aspect of the election before he was, you know, it was actually over. It was extremely adversarial with a lot of very venomous rhetoric against Sarkozy specifically. And I think that after Hollande was elected, all of that sort of faded away very, very quickly. And I mean, for myself, at least, I'm very much willing to give Hollande the, you know, the his chance. It's not like I've never made a secret in this show or others that I'm rather, you know, right wing leaning. But it's not like I hate the guy. I just, if he can prove himself and I really want him to succeed and I really want him to do a good job. So we'll see. You know, we've had a number of years of right wing government. I thought they didn't do too bad, but maybe left wing is going to work too. So we'll see what happens. And I think it's a belief that is, or a feeling that is shared by most of the country, even the right wing people. Of course, some people are going to say, you know, left wing is going to ruin the country. And it's the last time that there was a left wing president, a socialist president, it was in 81, it was Mitterrand. And 2 years after he got in power, the country got into such terrible shape that he had to reverse basically his whole policy. But I think Hollande seems like a smart guy, and there's what he says during the campaign and what he's actually going to do. And I don't know. We'll see. The biggest questions are on the EU level. So I guess that would be a good point to bring the transition to asking Maria what if that was even followed in Sweden, and what was the feeling?
Of course, we love Hollande. or
you,
oh my
dirty
God,
socialists,
feelings with the whole Swedish population.
I'm not sure. Go ahead.
No, the Swedish press loves him, and he feels like a fresh. New person, new actor on the EU scene, and his point of view at the big meeting with Merkel and the other EU leaders this week was he was perceived as one of the strongest figures there.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have a socialist government, right?
No. At the moment, we have a right-wing government, but...
Right, but Swedish
it's,
right-wing, so
really
basically it's...
not doing
it's
very
right.
well.
Okay.
The
I always want to... I always want to stop and define all these things for American listeners.
Well, I guess it's for...
Please, ask.
I just mean that I when you know, Patrick says, I'm kind of right-wing leaning, I always want to stop and say, no, for our American listeners, just want you to know... In France, the difference between the right and the left is very narrow compared to the United States.
And it's also
you don't go from a right-wing leader to a left-wing leader and have them try to completely reinvent all of the law like you do in the United States.
No, it's very as you're saying, you know, it's extremely, I mean, seen from the US, I've said that a couple of times, but even the right-wing government is, you know, pro social security, pro unemployment benefits, pro free education. So all of these are no question right-wing governments will enforce those as well.
I would even say the differences are so narrow that the amounts of money being spent aren't going to be very different. They're just going to have differences of opinion on what to spend the money on.
More or less. I mean, there's been a drive to – basically, that's one of the main things that opposes Hollande and – Merkel, or should we say Merkel and everyone else almost in the EU, they want, Merkel and others, a few others, want austerity. They want to reduce spending as much as possible. Hollande and others want to, you know, get us out of the crisis by spending and, you know, stimulating growth. The economy.
That's quite interesting because if you look in the Swedish press, we have been totally on Angela Merkel's side, mm-hmm. of the whole thing, that, you know, reduce costs.
Yeah.
But now when Hollande has made his entrance on the stage, suddenly the opinion has switched, and now
really?
Everybody's writing about this brilliant new idea about spending yourself out of the crisis.
Well, the problem is. One of the elements of spending yourself out of the crisis is that one of the elements of his policy is going to be not reducing spending and actually increasing spending on the government level, which raises a few eyebrows in France and I'm sure in other places. But I guess if you're going to spend, you're going to spend. But he wants to. One of the main adversarial points of his campaign was the fact that he wants to hire 60,000 teacher or education professionals in 5 years, within the next 5 years, 12.5k a year. And Sarkozy has reduced the number of government employees, and he wants to increase that. So obviously, it's not. And the way he's going to do to pay for it is to increase taxes, obviously. So, yeah, it's definitely that is something that a socialist government would do in France that a right-wing government would not necessarily be leaning towards too. So in that sense, we find the usual pictures that we have in other countries. So yeah, Maria,
and
sorry.
When I come on this show and I say that I'm more left-winged, when I discuss things with Patrick, I have come to realize that we are actually very close in our political views. It's just that he considers right-wing in France is almost left-wing in Sweden.
Yeah, exactly. That's one another thing that I often comment on, which is the right-wing. I mean, in my opinion, at least, I'm sure other French people would see things differently, but I think they're mistaken. The right-wing, I mean, France is very much to the left in general of the EU political spectrum. So our left wing is much to the left of every other left wing party in Europe, and our right wing is probably, you know,
to the left
to the center of the other countries. You know, they would be considered center.
Definitely, and our right wing are definitely more right wing than yours.
So. Okay,
they're also small, tiny.
You mean like in stature, like they're small people, or no? Okay, Kerwin, you've been silent. French, you know the English have been laughing at us for many, you know, any reason they can find because they hate the French anyway, right?
Probably.
Okay.
I don't know. I guess I certainly the financial sector has a lot to say about it.
They're panicking, you know, aren't they?
Well, there's a lot of people who think that it's just it's a crazy choice to bring in socialism and bring in the levels of expenditure that Hollande is talking about. And then there are a few other people who say, no, he'll be fine. He won't be able to do anything without the German Treasury okaying it anyway. Mm. This is sort of the, you know, this is a fairly elitist view, which assumes that everything is played out behind closed doors, and he can say one thing to the public when he's, you know, in the Elysee. He has to negotiate with Merkel on a much greater level than people will expect, and it'll be up to her a lot of the changes that he makes. You know, depending on how Merkel wants to finance the stabilization of the EU.
Yeah, there's I mean, Merkel has been in a very tough position as well. In the recent weeks, so
yeah, that's true. She's losing popularity in her own country, isn't she?
I mean, every government that was in place when the crisis hit has been ousted very, you know, clearly. So it's possible that she will too. But there's this big story about the Eurobonds, which I'm not sure I understand exactly. I believe they want to basically, how do you call it, merge the European debt with Eurobonds and ask people to buy Eurobonds to finance, you know, the euro, basically. And some people think it's a good idea, and some people think it's a bad idea. I'm not. It's been explained to me by clever people a couple of times. Right. I'm not sure I understand it completely. Do any of you guys have?
This is where we start peddling inaccuracies to our listeners, isn't it?
So no one has any idea what the Eurobonds actually do.
I don't know, but it's a great name. I mean, it sounds great. I'd buy them.
All right. So the little bit that I understand is the idea that you get bonds, you know, it's the same as government bonds, but on an EU level. So you would just keep the zone in a stable, you know, the currency in a stable state, because you sell them and guarantee them through bonds. So that's something that I'm not certain everyone is agreeing on. That would help get money into the EU and maybe help, you know, the Greece, which is financing the Greek debt, which is a terribly important topic at the moment. I believe there's also the topic of inflation, and one of the ways to alleviate the debts would be to inflate the currency, because obviously if the currency is worth less, you still owe 1,000 euros, let's say.
But it's easier to pay off.
Yeah, exactly, because there's inflation. Your salary and prices, let's say, get raised by 10% every year. That's just a number. So the 1,000 euros that you owed are easier to pay off. And that's something it has disadvantages, because, for example, people who have stable, you know, income that are not going to be raised, like retired people, they have a stable amount that is going to come every year. It's the amount that they're supposed to get. So if you do inflation, then you screw them over. But yeah, so that's another topic that is being discussed. I believe Germany does absolutely not want to hear about it. But
it's a traumatic subject for them. They are still remember all the lessons of the hyperinflation and in the Weimar years. It's really something that you can't talk about in the country, really, I believe.
It could be an easy solution, though, so I don't know.
Yes, the other thing that it's very difficult to talk about Germans with is the idea that the German economy is benefiting from the low euro right now, and that they're being able to export greatly. Whenever you bring that up, they always come back with, no, it's the high quality of our tech industries and the fact that we can sell things that no one else in the world can.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I found it funny recently how they get a bit jingoistic about that.
There are some moderate Germans who understand that they're as a country, they're in it together with the rest of the Eurozone, and they're benefiting from that partnership. Maybe they don't believe they're benefiting from that partnership as much as they're giving to it.
Yeah.
But there are some moderate Germans who get it.
Thank God. Another word on the Eurobonds. The word I was looking for was mutualization. I don't know if it actually exists in English, but it does in French. It does. Okay, thank you. So basically, you get all of the debt of all the European countries together, and you transform them into bonds. And so the risk is leveled on the EU level. And that's what I was trying to explain in a very poor manner.
Maybe then you could re-slice them into different combinations. So then you can sell off, you know, the premium tranches with the subprime Greek tranches and call it all, you know, AAA rated.
I think that is a great idea.
The Americanization of European debt. How's that?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I wonder if there would be much. I would love to see that experiment. I'd like to see just how much investment comes from which parts of the world in that experiment.
Well, the thing is, there's no clear solution, right? It's the crisis is still there, and the situation in Greece is still absolutely terrible. And there's no
I think
easy
we
solution
have reached
there.
A point when everybody's agreeing on what we have tried to do so far is not working. It's not working at all. So now we have to think about solutions and think about outside the box.
So I guess the question is, what is the solution people are going to gravitate towards? And in France, at least, it looks like we're going to be pushing towards spending ourselves out of the crisis. We'll see what happens. I mentioned Greece for a second there, and obviously that has also been a huge topic in France. I'm wondering if it was, I mean, I'm sure in the UK and Sweden it was as well, right? Yes?
Yes.
Was
definitely.
What?
Greece. And the crisis and the... So they got a new election, right? They got an election and they didn't manage to form a government out of the election because no one had the majority. And the problem is still today, at least that's my feeling, that the Greeks That is going to sound terrible, but that's really my assessment of the situation. They don't want to take responsibility for the situation that they're in. And certainly others have a part, you know, partial responsibility for it. But I think that by, you know, cutting the debt in half and helping by giving billions over and billions of euros is taking responsibility. And the other part, you know, the other half of the responsibility is that they haven't been paying their taxes, because they do everything under the table, and the country, the structure of the country is terrible. And there was a comment just this week, this weekend, I believe, by Christine Lagarde, who's the new IMF director, who said, the Greeks need to, basically what she said, they need to shut up, buckle up, and start paying their taxes, because we have actual people in, you know, poor African countries that actually have problems and that need our help. So we're not going to bail out the Greeks, and they need to shut up and do something about their situation. So I don't know. No, you're not happy with that.
Can I just put in something here?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I feel there is in such, I mean, average Greek person is in such poor situation right now. So it's a little bit like telling the guy on the table that is having a heart attack that, you know, you should really cut down on smoking and you shouldn't have drank all those drinks and you shouldn't eat all that fatty food. But, I mean, we need to give him CPR now, you know. So this is is in the past.
I guess that's definitely true. But the thing is, the CPR has been administered, if we keep with that analogy, which I'm sure is going to break down horribly in a couple of seconds. The CPR was cutting the debt in half and sending billions and billions of money in help. At one point, you know, okay, I don't know exactly how much the average Greek person is getting in you know, monthly salary if they're a government employee, for example, but if they have enough to eat some kind of food and have shelter, then they have enough to live, you know? It's not like they're dying diseased in the streets. So if they do have a large part of responsibility in this crisis, which is what I've been led to believe, maybe I'm mistaken, maybe it would be worth hunkering down and saying, okay, we're going to get through this. It's going to be a horrible 5 years, and we're going to get through it because we're going to be cutting down and everyone is going to start paying their taxes and living on ridiculously low amounts of money, and we're going to get through it.
So the definition of a successful state is wherein the state has a monopoly on the use of force. And ultimately, if you have a trend toward people not paying taxes, you also have a trend toward the failure of a state, because at some point there's this tipping point where there are so many people refusing to pay their taxes that includes the people who would enforce that. The people who would literally go point a gun at someone and say, you're going to jail unless you pay your taxes, are themselves not willing to pay their taxes.
I'm not sure where you're going with this.
I'm saying that that ultimately, if you're past that point, you have to have an external agency come in and do something. There is some point where there is such a failure in the entire country to bring itself together that you're not going to be able to just talk them into all changing what they're doing. There's too many of them in the trend.
I guess so. The thing is, here, it's not just about the country itself. It's also about the stability of the Eurozone in general. And I think what a lot of people are saying, if we're talking about the past, is, you know, we should have never accepted we should never have gotten Greece and Spain and Portugal into the EU to begin with, because their economies weren't, you know, sound. But now there is this issue that we as European can't really afford to. We're not going to send in the army, right? We're not going to say send in, you know, armed people to make them pay their taxes. They have to do it.
Then the only other option. everyone pays higher taxes. Everyone. In the entire Eurozone.
Well, no, that's not going to happen either because it's already happened.
Sorry.
It's already been... We're at the point now, again, this is my analysis of the situation. Now, I think it's representative of a part of the French population. There are a lot of people, especially in the left wing, who say, "Ah, oh, poor Greek, you know, population. They're being crushed by the weight of liberal capitalism, and it's horrible. And we should, I don't know, really, what their solution is. You know, maybe they should say we should give them more money and forget all of their debt and just let them keep going what they're doing." But that, to get back to Marie's lovely image.
Well, he do have to stop drinking.
Yeah, exactly.
And smoking as well. Otherwise, he would just have another heart attack.
So. Exactly. So at some point, they have to start, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. And I don't feel like there is, you know, in this 12-step programs, usually you have a point where you have to recognize what the problem is. And the main gripe here is, I believe, that they're not recognizing what the problem is. They're not understanding that they have at least a part of responsibility in this. That's, again, my image of the whole thing. Kerwin, you're being very silent.
This has been explained to me in a particular way by a Greek friend, which is that, and he's someone who is mixed ethnicity as well. So he kind of moved to Greece as a teenager, I believe. So he kind of, his education was there, but he can see it somewhat as an outsider, some as an insider. And what he thinks is that because Greece is maybe not quite as badly as Italy, but in some ways it's a new country that does not have the strong sense of statist nationalism, of which French is perhaps the most superlative example. So there's a Greek people that's always been there, but the state, the idea of the state being the possession and the ward of the Greek people is not so strong. So when the Greek government does something irresponsible, the Greek people don't feel responsible for their actions. They see them as a separate entity. So that also goes to why they don't pay taxes, because they have a basic mistrust of the government to begin with. I mean, the US has the same thing for a lot of people. But I guess... There are a lot of people who will say economically they're going through a crisis and politically there's something of an awakening happening in Greece, so that the way that they are sort of coming together and forming this sort of statist nationalist national identity, this idea that collectively they're going to come together and do something about what their government is doing. Now, they might be doing the wrong thing to begin with or what. But this might be the turning point in the Greek people taking responsibility for their government in a way they didn't believe they had to before.
Right. Yeah, and it's true. I'm being a little bit knowingly flippant and flip about it. And I'm saying, oh, they should just, you know, just pay their taxes and that's it. I understand it's a very difficult situation. It's a horrible situation. And it's not an easy situation in the sense that, as you're saying, Kerwin, the realization of all of this might be coming from this crisis. And it's not going to happen in a couple of days or weeks or months either. So maybe now is what the process that they're going through is going to lead them eventually to actually having that understanding of a modern democracy and the meaning of a modern democracy, if that is indeed is the case, that they don't feel that the government is a representative of their identity, maybe that is going to bring that, and it's going to take, you know, a couple of years. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. And then there's also a lot of commentators, obviously more left-wing side, that are saying the fact that they are resisting the diagnosis and the prognosis of the European Union and the German government and the IMF is also a great victory for socialism, or, you know, the anti-capitalist and globalization movement. It's a first place where people have really thrown off this idea that finance rules and things like that.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that effect in France too. The problem with all this is that you don't really see a credible solution coming out of those ranks. At least I don't see it. It might be there, but you know, in the case of Greece specifically, I don't know what they can do. That, you know, if you're saying, okay, let's not take the money from the EU, or let's make all of the responsibility borne by the EU, I'm not sure exactly how that, you know, the solution comes out of that analysis. But
well, there's another side to this, which I'm sort of surprised no one's mentioned it yet, and maybe this is an indication that it's much more of interest in the UK, which is the idea of Greece leaving the euro.
Yeah,
we're all talking about how the debt's going to be restructured, but here there's a lot more talk. Well, and it's partly the fact that the UK is not in the euro, so it can glib about those who are.
Yeah.
But the UK perspective a lot of times seems to be, well, just leave quickly and get it over and done with, and then we'll worry about fixing up the economy once it's got its own, you know, fiscal policy under its own control.
So that's, interestingly enough, that's something that has been mentioned, you know, in a hush-hush tone many times.
It's become really less hush-hush in the UK, I think. And Paul Krugman as well in New York, he wrote a 200, like only 200 word post last week saying, "This is, we've been talking about this and this is how we decided the end game is going to play out. Greece leaves the euro possibly in the next 2 days, yada, yada, yada." That was, you know, he thought it would be happening as quickly as that. And I think people in the UK are expecting it to sort of happen every day.
Yeah.
I think they're sort of expecting that to happen as fast as bankruptcies occur in New York and London, that kind of thing.
Well, the thing is,
I've got a question. I know that there are some in England who read Krugman. Do you think that he gets any press across Europe?
Not in France.
I don't know about Europe. He's definitely a known entity in the UK. But then I'm also based at a place where he used to work and teach, where his name is even more well known. But I would say most people, even when we go to offices and engineers and like that, if I am trying to talk about the sort of blogosphere, Paul Krugman isn't a name I can refer to talk about a specific type of blog.
There's definitely a language barrier in France. I'm sure I'm sure the economists will, you know and reference and read Krugman, but in France also, I mean, but in general, you don't see a lot of people even understanding the outside view of the economy. France is very much ruled by France, and the way we view things is informed by our analysis. And you have very few people who get informed, who get educated on other people's views. And I think that's why a lot of people believe that the French right wing is very much right wing. And you know, that kind of misconception about the French political and economic background. But to get back to the idea of Greece leaving the eurozone, when I'm saying hush hush tones, it's basically an eventuality which is seen as far in the distance, and we're not there yet. And it's also seen, I believe, as that would be abandoning them. And of course, it would be a bad thing for Europe in general, because it means that the eurozone is kind of unstable. I mean, who else would be taken out after that? We would much rather, it would make the financial aspects of the EU a little bit more sound, but at the same time, it would mean that people can get out of the EU, and that means that we don't know what would happen next. So in that sense, it would come bring a little bit of instability. And it also, again, I think there's a feeling of that would mean we're abandoning Greece, because if they're out, then we don't really care anymore. You know, they go back to the drachma and or whatever their money was, and that's it. Whatever, you do whatever you want. And We don't want to do that, I don't think. We want to save them in spite of themselves, almost. It's not like if they leave the EU, that's a feeling that I think maybe they have and some people have out elsewhere. They're like, oh, the EU is the cause of all our ills, and if we leave, everything's going to be great. And that nothing could be further from the truth, at least in my opinion. You know, what are they going to do that is magically going to make everything great if they leave? The situation is going to be the same. They're still going to have no money, and the economy is still in the toilet, so they're not going to have any tourism, which is the backbone of their economy.
I guess the UK perspective, and I think it's interesting how different the media really are in our two countries, but here the perspective is if they go out of the euro, they've got their own economy on the interest rate policies and everything else under their own control, and they're not having to play to the interest levels set by Germany and France and the other big economies in the eurozone.
Obviously, they would have more flexibility.
So it's getting talked about here as a sort of, you're saying it's a sort of perhaps an inevitable far-off thing. Mm. Here it's something that's considered inevitable, and it's believed that the Eurocrats are working on it right now to work out as quickly as possible how to help Greece leave the Eurozone as gracefully as possible.
Yeah.
And it's seen here as probably a good thing, of course, not by those people who have kind of personal connections to Greece who are really worried about the capital flight and things like that, which is true. There is a lot of capital flying out of Greece now and lodging in other currencies.
I mean, certainly they would have more independence in the way they want to fix their economy, but the economy is still in the toilet, and it's not like the things they're complaining about, the people are complaining about, meaning they have, you know, cut down on their salaries when they're, you know, and unemployment and things like that, that is not going to get fixed if they leave the EU. So it's still going to be a very difficult couple of years or 5 years or whatever it ends up being. But Randy, any last thoughts on Greece and our Eurozone?
No, we've talked about it way too long.
Okay. You're American, aren't you? let's talk about gay homosexuals instead. There's a line in our show notes that says gay marriage, and I think it's been an item in the U.S. So, Randy, are you the one who added it, or
I did not?
Okay,
but I think I'm happy to me who added it.
Okay, well, let's discuss. Kerwin, please let us know what's been happening with gay homosexuals who have sex with other people of the same gender.
As opposed to all those other kind of homosexuals who, I don't know.
I'm playing to our...
Lock themselves in loveless marriages or hide under long frocks and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
I put it in there, but it was partly because of the announcements made in the US and partly of the way they seem to ripple around the world. It turned it into, from my perspective, a global debate for a moment, because so Biden made his announcement, Obama that was
Biden,
making his announcement.
Biden is gay?
Okay, so no, wait. So the you know, we're talking about the month of May, and there was definitely an uptick in discussion and in politic about this subject. And it started 3 weeks ago when on a weekly news television show that is very consistent in the United States called Meet the Press, the Vice President of the United States in an interview with the host of that show just sort of blurted out, and he's known for going places that interviewers don't expect, just said, we need to support same-sex marriage. This needs to be something that the national discussion gets passed, and we get on to guaranteeing this equal right for homosexuals in the United States. And that in and of itself isn't terribly controversial, but it was, you know, the first time that a vice president level official in the United States had ever said something like that publicly. And then a few days later, that means there are people in the White House press are asking the president to speak on such things, and he did, and he said a lot of the same stuff.
So what I noticed was that it set off a debate in Australia again, where 2/3 of the country support it, and the left wing, the Labour Prime Minister, who is an unmarried woman with her male partner, it's the first sort of de facto couple in our government. She still refuses it, and Australia not only makes it impossible for Australian citizens to marry in Australia, it also makes it difficult for Australian citizens to marry overseas if it's going to be a gay marriage, which is one step further. That's right, and that's one step further than a lot of other countries will go. Even the US allows its gay citizens to marry abroad if they want, I believe. Yes. The other place that I noticed was that from the Philippines, Manny Pacquiao, who is, you know, the greatest boxer pound for pound in the world today, and he's won 7 weight division titles. He's become a congressman in the Philippines, but he's also famous for being a very devout Catholic, and he instantly came out against gay marriage. And that made news in the Philippines. So I think it really resonated around the world. So it's never really been a global topic, I don't think. But perhaps this has turned it into one.
Mm. Maria, you're, you know, from liberal Scandinavia, and
well, gay marriage is legal here.
I was going to do a great intro by saying that, you know, everyone's gay in your countries, and like you're all gay and homosexuals. And I was half expecting you to tell me that you're gay or something, but you ruined it. So
we're all a little bit gay, isn't that the answer?
Yeah, I think, you know, I really love that. I can't remember who said it, but there was somebody who posited that basically no one is 100% straight or 100% gay, and you know you'll have like 90% and 10% of one and the other, or you know somewhere in the middle. And I really love that image. I think there's a lot of truth to it, but
I believe so too. Yeah. But I'm curious because I mean we take this as it's a basic human rights. Of course, you should be able to marry whatever sex you are. But I'm actually not sure. Is gay marriage okay in France?
Is it okay?
is it gay allowed? Marriage?
No, it's not. It's not legal. It did have a little bit of play in the campaign. A few people did discuss it when Obama mentioned said what he said. It's the right wing, I mean Sarkozy, was against it, and Hollande is for it. So there's a chance that it will go through during his administration. And I don't know. I mean, it's still being debated. It's funny when this whole, I'm going to go very personal here. When this whole debate happened a few years ago, I mean, it's cyclical. It comes back every few years. I remember asking myself the question, you know, I'm obviously, I don't know. I have no problem with gay people. And I think, you know, I have I have a few gay friends. But I wasn't sure, you know, as long as you have, there was this question that I believe a lot of people are asking themselves. If you have a civil union, which we do, that gives you the same rights as marriage, why is it a big deal that you would want to get the same kind of union with the word marriage on it? Especially if, you know, it's probably not going to happen in a church, even if, you know, the state is going to say it's okay to get married, but you're not going to get your marriage in a church, probably not, especially in France where it's mostly Catholic and you don't have those weird Protestants that do whatever they want by, you know, on a church by church basis. So I was wondering, you know, what's the big deal with the word marriage? And I spent a little bit of time thinking about it, trying to decide whether or not I was for or against gay marriage. And small aside point, I remember when I first started getting a little bit of a name as a podcaster, I purposefully didn't say anything about myself and my sexual orientation. I didn't talk about girlfriends.
Oh, I thought you were gay for sure.
I don't know why. I don't know why, but I remember that a few people asked the question, Maria, maybe you can, you know, tell me, why did you think I was gay? A lot of people thought so, because I'm, you know, so good looking and elegant.
I think you implied it. I think there was kind of a joke in it, and there was some, you know, talk between you and Scott that kind of implied that you were.
Yeah, maybe
so
that was
weren't it. Really sure.
Yeah, and I never. So that's what I mean. I purposefully didn't clarify anything, and there was some joking about, you know, something like that. So I that's to say, I was wondering. You know, I was trying to decide for myself about the gay marriage issue, but I was definitely not, you know, I was more than it doesn't mean anything to say pro-gay, but I'm very okay with homosexuality in general. I think it, you know, I'm not at all someone who would think homosexuals, you know, are an aberration of nature or anything like that, or even that they make me uncomfortable. I'm completely the opposite.
But why are you saying that the homosexual marriage wouldn't happen in a church? In Sweden, it happens in the church all the time.
Because you're weird and Protestants, and you have gay Protestant, you know, priests.
Oh, yeah.
And so anyway, so I was trying to decide, and the conclusion I came down to, and that's, you know, my explanation for it, I made a blog post on my blog at the time, is that marriage is sort of, the idea of marriage is sort of an innate feeling in the human race. Because you have that feeling that sometimes you love someone and you want to be united and you want to declare your undying love to that person and you want to show it and you know, have that feeling labeled, basically. And it just happens that the label we've chosen for that universal feeling is the word marriage. So if you say we're civilly unionized, united, you're sort of using a different word than the word that's universally and socially accepted for that relationship. So the same way that, you know, it's a little bit of an extreme example, but you could have a bus for black people and a bus for white people, and you're still getting on the bus and you're still getting to the place you want to get to. What does it matter? Well,
but it's all about, you know, equality.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, if you have to label it differently, then it means that you feel differently about that thing. And in this case, I think that the relationship is universal. And if you think that someone, a man or a woman, can love a man or a woman, you know, in the same way that you love your wife or husband or whatever, then you have to, you know, probably I would say, my opinion is, you have to agree that you can label their relationship as a marriage, because that's the way we've agreed to call it. And it doesn't matter that the church or, you know, whoever sort of co-opted that word, that term, and said, nope, that word only applies to men and women, and you can have your word. It doesn't matter that they said that first, because the word has been decided to apply to that type of relationship. So anyway,
I'm very curious.
There was some group that said, and the white bus must be painted white, and the black bus must be painted black, and we're going to not allow you to ever paint the black bus white, that you start seeing all sorts of differences.
Yeah.
And there's and the problem is you can't come up with a good reason why you shouldn't be able to paint the black bus white. We're just inventing reasons. There's not an actual reason to stand on.
The core reason behind all of this is that deep inside, if you get to the core of it, is that you feel differently about the person in the black bus and in the person in the white bus. You know, you consider them a little bit differently. And that's, I believe it also applies to this question of gay marriage. But sorry, Maria, you were going to ask the question.
No, I'm just curious to ask Randy, what kind of political ramifications this, I mean, what did it do to Obama's ratings that he made this statement?
Not much. The United States is in a pretty set pattern as far as the populace goes. There are we could have the election tomorrow. There's not going to be much shift in any sort of votes. There's a percentage that anytime they're asked to name his popularity or the likelihood they're going to vote for him, they always give the lowest rating. They would vote for anyone other than Obama. That's a set percentage. It's not changing. So it doesn't matter whether he comes out in favor of things that they don't favor. They're already set. All he can do is at this point is either increase the likelihood of the rest of the country going and voting for him or decrease it. And I thought it was pretty ballsy to do this now with an election in a few months. I think there are a lot of people who said that it means a lot more to take a stand before everybody judges you at the polls than after.
I've heard an interesting analysis of this on the French in the French media, which was actually Mitt Romney is very much to the left of the Republican Party, right? So he's almost in the center. So by taking that stance, what Obama and Biden are doing is they're forcing Romney to take a stance to dive farther at the right of the Republican Party, thus sort of asphyxiating his likely center or left-wing votes and forcing him to be really Republican.
That's kind of been the story of his whole candidacy, isn't it?
Well, his response has been to do nothing. I'm sorry?
Romney's response has been to do nothing, to not stake out a strong position.
He's been asked, I'm guessing.
Yes. He's going to say, I favor the status quo. We've got bigger issues to talk about, this sort of thing. And it's a fairly smart strategy, but it's not winning him any votes. Like I say,
it's not losing him votes either.
Right. But between now and the election, you're either saying and doing things that cause people to leave the house and go vote for you, or you aren't. Obama took a little bit of a calculated risk, and he's been a masterful calculator as a politician. This issue, though, it isn't just relegated to presidential politics and the question of when will the United States ever federalize same-sex marriage. It will eventually. The issue is all over the states in the United States, and you have states that have state governments that are far to the left of others, where same-sex marriage is being implemented in various ways. And then you have states that are going to the polls every weekend and voting on measures to reinforce their anti-same-sex marriage laws that they already have.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting. It's interesting to see the United States fracture over that issue. Mm-hmm. And you have a situation now where you can literally drive from one state to the neighboring state, California to Arizona, and the rules change dramatically based on your sexuality.
Interesting. Kerwin, any last words on the gay marriage question that you brought up?
Well, it's something I can really talk about for a very long time.
You have 2.5 minutes. Go.
Okay. Well, there was one thing that I think, I agree with a lot of what's been said, but there's another sort of more abstract or theoretical way that I've been looking at it, which is that, we've constructed an idea that marriage has to be about love, when the reality is there can actually be many motives for marriage historically. And certainly lots of different motives for heterosexual marriages, and there might be just as much diversity with homosexual marriages. I think that a different way to look at it is to say, what does it mean for the extended families? And what I mean by that is that there's sort of three ways to expand and extend family.
See? You go from gay marriages to three ways. Now you're, you know, pretty soon you're going to be talking. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. So basically, the first way is you can be born into a family. The second way is you can marry into it. And the third way is you can be adopted into it. So do any of these really need to be gendered or be based on any traditional or social roles or anything like that? You could be really theoretical about it and say, well, adoption is to bring someone into a family in a hierarchical relationship, and a marriage brings someone into a family in a peer-to-peer relationship. So you could, you know, if you were a straight man, you could marry a woman for the convenience of, you know, supporting each other's children or forming a platonic household or something like that. Why might that not be possible in a gay marriage as well, if you have two people who are not necessarily in love with each other but who need companionship, who one might have children from other marriages or something like that, bring them into your immediate family, bring them into your extended family.
You're stretching it, though. You're going to the really theoretical levels.
That's one thing I was thinking about. And then today I was talking about this with a friend, and she really brought home with a very different point of view, which is that all the discussion of gay marriage ends up becoming such a narrow thing to focus on that we end up distracted from what she sees as the larger issue, which is a culture of intolerance against all kinds of things, but homosexuals and homosexuality in particular, but that the sort of the intolerance and the xenophobia towards gays, which plays out in many different ways other than just whether or not they can marry, is something that we ought to be addressing as societies, and we don't when we narrow the argument just to whether or not civil union is enough, whether it should go to marriage, etc., etc. So, and she's drawing from one journalist who said, never forget that this is not about gay marriage, it's about Bradley Manning. Which is a very strange place to take it. I don't know if everyone remembers, but Bradley Manning was the soldier who gave all of the documents to WikiLeaks, all of the diplomatic cables, and it's imputed that his sexuality was part of the issue, that he was actually ostracized from the military because of his sexuality, and that was part of the psychology of his relationship and his actions and things like that. Mm. Now, I don't quite see how it can be drawn.
It's a little bit of a stretch, I think.
I think the lesson to take from that sort of argument, though, is that intolerance towards gays and towards anyone else is manifesting in a lot of ways at the moment, and some are very insidious and some are out in the open, but we should be working out ways to talk about all of them.
I think the thing is, the gay marriage thing is a very concrete and strong way and signal of saying, you know, it's not just about allowing gays to marry. It's about saying you are fully accepted members of society, and you have the same right as everyone else. So you don't really need to say there is basically fighting homophobia means to trying to affirm homosexuals are shouldn't be ostracized, and allowing gays to marry is a way of saying that as well. So I think that's why it is a valid point to focus on that question alone, even if it does seem a little bit narrow at times.
Yeah.
Anyone wants to defend or expose the other side's opinion on this? Because I've realized that we're very liberal on this show, and we're not even, you know, acknowledging that maybe there are some, I would have a hard time understanding that there are valid points in the other camp, I think, but anyone cares to, you know, mention what they could be?
I can't what they could be.
Okay, I guess the main thing is marriage should be about family and a man and a woman and having children and raising children and stuff like that. And the problem is, every one of those points is so easily countered that I don't know. I mean,
is gay adoption allowed in France and England?
I don't think so.
We do have it here. Yeah.
Yes, it is allowed here.
Maybe it is. You know, I'm not even sure. But you know, that's a strong argument as well. A lot of people will tell you, well, if you don't have a standard family structure, then the children are going to get screwed. And if that was true, maybe it would be a valid point against gay marriage. But the fact is that it's absolutely not. You know, we have now a history of a few decades of seeing what happens when you know, gay people raise children. And not only are they usually absolutely, you know, well-raised and happy, but they don't even become gay like it's some sort of infection thing or education thing, you know? They're most, I believe, gay parents have straight children. And I'm sure they have gay children too, but, you know, it's not... So it isn't... Even that point isn't really valid, in my opinion, so...
Right, anyway. And if you could wave a magic wand and somehow make every homosexual on the planet disappear and hopefully go live out the rest of their natural lives on a very happy gay planet, the population would immediately start re-homosexualing itself, because almost every single gay person you've ever known was the product of a heterosexual relationship.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I guess anti-gay marriage doesn't have a strong voice in the Phileas Club. And for that, dear anti-gay marriage people, we are almost sorry. Facebook. Who wants to talk about the Facebook IPO, which was, I believe, we usually try to stay away a little bit from the tech topics. Mm-hmm. In this show, but this was definitely more than a tech topic. The Facebook IPO finally happened. Biggest tech IPO in the history of tech IPOs. Started at $38, went up a tiny bit, but it didn't pop. It didn't shoot up. And it is now a little bit lower, about 10%. So a lot of people are calling it a bust.
And they're also calling it a bust because it was clear on the day, which was 8 days ago as we're recording this, it was clear on the day and has become more and more clear that there were a lot of shady tricks and bad deals being brought to bear by the people organizing the initial public offering.
Yeah. There's talks of lawsuits.
And the thing is, there were talks of lawsuits before the trading started 8 days ago. It's just an overplaying of the hand that Facebook had to play. They had the opportunity to make a ridiculous fortune in this IPO and do it like everyone else, and instead of just doing it like everyone else, they decided to make three or four ridiculous fortunes, and they stretched too far with too many organizers, too many people trying to do profiteering along with them.
Well, I read a very different analysis. I think it was I can't remember which blog it was on, but I'm gonna tell you about it in a minute. But first, I want to ask Maria and Kerwin if it was also a big deal in their countries. I mean, in France, it was talked about. It wasn't a huge deal. We mentioned it a few times in the news reports. But what about you guys?
It was quite big here, but we were also advised by you know, people who knows not to buy the stock because it was said that it was grossly overvalued compared to what the company actually is bringing in.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion
about that. It was considered extremely risky.
What about you, Kerwin?
I think it was big news here, and I think there are people playing all sides of the field. I don't know. There wasn't. It seems like in America, it was much more unilaterally. Facebook had stuffed up their chances. Although I guess I'm not sure whether the outcry is that they acted in bad faith or poor taste, or that they didn't make as much money as they ought to have. If they, you know, if it's the Facebook, the private shareholders have made a fortune at the expense of the new, the people who've bought into the IPO, I guess I'm not sure if I'm concerned about that, because I guess I feel maybe more fool them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what the I'm very sorry, I don't remember who made that analysis, but a lot of people don't sort of misunderstand by what he's saying the purpose of an IPO. The people who speculate are the ones who got screwed, because people wanted to buy stock at $38, which was the introduction price, and they were hoping for it to pop and to go to, I don't know, 45, 50, maybe more, and sell it within a few hours or maybe a day. And that didn't happen. And the purpose of the IPO isn't to make money for people who are speculating. The purpose is for the company to raise as much capital as it can. So the game is to try and set the price of their shares to the biggest level, the biggest amount that the market can bear. And if they do that in a very, you know, accurate way, then the stock is not going to pop. They are going to sell it for as much as the market is going to pay for it. And given that, it's not going to go higher. And they are going to rake in as much money as they can. And if it does go back down after that, it's not really their problem anymore. They've already gotten all the money that they could get. So after that, it's shareholders that are going to get a little bit screwed. And certainly within, you know, 6 months, a year, 10 years, this becomes important again. But a lot of people expect the stock to be down to $20, $15 in 6 months. And at that point, Facebook really doesn't care all that much. Later, it's going to become important again, as I was saying. But I thought that analysis was very interesting. It wasn't discussed in such great lengths in France. But yeah, so for speculators, yeah, it wasn't a great deal. But for Facebook, they did as well as they could have hoped for. It went great for them.
You can refer to speculation as a bad idea as much as you want.
Sorry, that's not what I was doing. I'm just saying that the people who are pissed off are the ones who are the speculators, you know,
right,
which is a different story than the success of the IPO.
The point I want to make is that they're speculating, they're buying that IPO in the first minute it's available on, they're speculating in a regulated market, and they're speculating based on certain facts that are being disclosed about that security. And if those facts are in dispute, if the method by which those facts were disclosed is in dispute, if the regulations of the market were broken by any parties, then they have a case that there is foul play. And
agreed.
And in this particular case, there is so much rumor, maybe not a lot of evidence, but there's so much more rumor of foul play than we've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
It's really spectacular.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just, you know, trying to set, because a lot of people have been saying the Facebook IPO was botched, and it was, you know, it was a failure for Facebook. I'm just trying to say, I don't think it was a failure. They got as much money, they raised as much capital as they could have hoped for, obviously.
But it was botched. And the simple way to look at that is, if Facebook had Facebook closed yesterday at over $31, so it has lost $2.5 billion in market capitalization in the last week.
But it hasn't lost any money.
Right. But I'm saying, if Facebook had IPO'd at $30 8 days ago, not only would Facebook have still made an insane amount of money and capitalized on an incredible uptick in brand value and so forth, but we wouldn't be talking about it in any negative terms right now.
I'm not sure Facebook cares. You're saying they could have made, you know, $30 per share or $38 per share. Obviously, they want to make $38 per share. You know, it's 30% more. I think they want 30% more money in their safes to be able to function and buy companies and, you know, right?
If I don't know, I don't know, I don't know what the answer to that question will be 6 months from now.
If, yeah, maybe.
If it has, you know, if it's continued to fall and they've continued to lose value and so forth.
I think it's going to continue to fall. It's going to take a long time before Facebook can prove that it has a you know, a model that can sustain such a high market cap. But that's a little bit far from the topic of the
right.
Know,
it was a huge topic of the month of April 2012 for sure.
Okay, Maria, do you want to a few words about Facebook, or do you not care about their market cap?
Maria has stepped away. Maria is back.
Maria has just come back.
Okay.
Did you see my message?
Okay. No, I didn't. Yes, very interesting. Okay, let's move on.
Very interesting stuff, guys.
What were you doing? Baby stuff again? Babies, seriously.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. What were we going to talk about? Changwon Chang. Randy, you wanted to touch on that.
Definitely one of the biggest stories in the United States, and I'm guessing in the free press part of China and the regions around China. That's purely a guess. But in North America, a huge story. Late April, the
it was pretty big in France, too. Yeah.
Oh, good, good. In late April, the now famous Chinese dissident civil rights activist, Changwon Chang, which a lot of Americans just know as the blind Chinese activist. he had been living in at-home detention for years after being in prison. The Chinese had a pretty verifiable history of this house arrest being violent, being you know, his family being persecuted constantly for years and years. In the middle of the night, late April, he slipped over the wall, which is I love the idea of a blind man escaping a prison. That just I love that, and a lot of people do. He slipped over the wall, made it to a whole network of activists got him all the way to Beijing, and then he found his way possibly into the United States Embassy in China.
That's not been confirmed still, right?
Yes, it has not been confirmed, although you have to wonder when someone suddenly starts posting on YouTube where they're doing it from, if not the United States Embassy in China. It would be a lot of fun if we had found out that he was in the French embassy or some, you know, some place you never expect, right? But
I didn't realize that went unconfirmed. I thought it was taken for granted that that's where he was.
I think everyone.
Oh, yeah, that's how the Swedish media put it as well.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe it was. Yeah, it's possible.
I have never seen any firm confirmation. I will guarantee you that if his initial sort of amnesty was granted in. I will guarantee you it was granted in someone's embassy. I will bet you he was not in a Chinese hotel room, is what I'm saying. And I will bet you
probably
he went
not
through the U.S. embassy. I know he went. I mean, there's a picture of him walking out of the U.S. embassy with a U.S. diplomat named Kirk Campbell. So from there, he was able to start getting a much wider audience on his activism, and he has he basically sat and portrayed China, especially rural China, as being absolutely no different than it was under Mao, as being a police state where people are brutally treated by the state for any reason or no reason, anytime, and live in fear and terror. And the United States felt like they had to get him out because keeping him in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing was untenable. And so the discussions were very straightforward. What can we do to keep the Chinese government saving some face on this?
Sorry to interrupt, Randy. Were these his message? Was it shown in the U.S. media? Because we only heard, he's a dissident, but we didn't see what he was doing. Did you guys see it in the media?
No.
So how do
again,
you know?
Because I've read all of the, I've read his story very carefully. I've followed all of the links on Wikipedia from his Wikipedia article and so forth. In the U.S. media, you have.
Hello?
Because, Hillary Rodham Clinton today, the Secretary of State, approved the travel of a Chinese dissident from China to the United States, and now they're just trying to work out the details to get him out of China without China exploding. And that's it. You really don't get a lot of detail.
Yeah, that's what we got too. It was basically that level of detail.
A lot of the best details are come from people who translated YouTube videos and from news sources that are, I don't want to say left wing, but a little more in depth in the United States and go to great detail. The New York Times eventually ran a full expose on him and his story. Yeah. And then, like I say, on the 19th and 20th of May, he managed to board a plane, get a visa to visit the United States, and went to New York City.
Right. Well, that was basically, it was a much even bigger story, I think, here, because we followed the, when he left the embassy, whichever one he was in, he actually went back home and at first said, everything is okay, everything's fine. And then he was saying, actually, it's not. I'm afraid for my life and my family.
His initial goal was not to leave the country. Hmm. His initial goal was just to get some focus on his problem of his family being beaten all the time.
Right.
And, he told a story about how the police had come in at one point in where he was living in house under house arrest. The police had just come in and taken all of his kids' toys and just taken the toys.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. It's really terrible.
Well,
but
you're not a parent, Patrick. Yeah.
No, I know, but
horrible.
It's like, no, but imagine, I know, but it's like the police comes in and is like, take the Transformers, or I'm sure, the Transformers are not, the Chinese kids are not going to play with Transformers, but okay. Anyway, okay,
So originally all he wanted was a normal life. He was promising China he would not be an activist, he would not do anything public, just give me a normal life back. Yeah. And they sort of said okay. and then he went back to his family and found out it was not okay.
Yeah. So obviously it was a big story here. Quickly, Maria and Kerwin, same for you guys?
Oh, yeah. This is such a perfect story, isn't it? He's blind and he is doing all these good things and, good versus evil. This is, I found more than 300 articles in Swedish magazines about this.
Same in the UK?
It was a big story here. I mean, the one thought I've been having about it is I found it funny how the solution to his problem is to give him a fellowship in a U.S. university where he can make even more noise against the Chinese. I guess it's sort of funny that the Chinese think that's an acceptable solution.
I guess, yeah. Well, I think if he's in the U.S., The thing
outside
is
outside the Great Firewall of
China.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, he's not. You have a lot of people outside of China who are, denouncing the Chinese regime. Yeah. And it's not the same when you're in the country, I'm sure. So
there's also the fact the Chinese claim that keeping him under house arrest was costing them a fortune, which, you know, so they've alleviated themselves of that cost. And I just can't fully understand. They said something like that they had spent $10 million imprisoning this guy over the last few years. And that is just ludicrous to me. Why wouldn't the solution just be to leave him alone? Just cut him off so he can't, if you're going to exercise that police power to keep someone from influencing others, then do that. But how does it cost so much money?
Well, Randy, when you have your own, you know, despotic regime and you have to deal with dissidents, we'll see how you deal with them.
I'm sure you won't be leaving them alone. I think maybe China considers it money well spent for one reason, and that is that he is depicting that country that country's leadership and politics as absolutely awful. His depiction of what he has suffered and what they are capable of and doing constantly to their populace, it is African dictatorship level stuff. And I think that China may have miscalculated here. I think he may open some doors and windows to something that they don't really want the rest of the world to see.
Interesting. Well, I guess we'll see what happens in the next few months and years. Let's move on to our local stories. I think I've talked about mine, which is the French elections. Anyone else wants to add something to their local stuff? Kerwin, you mentioned local elections.
Well, yeah, there were local elections, you know, mayoral elections across the UK or local councils and things like that, which was in most of the country. It was a huge swing against the Conservative government that's in power. But the interesting race for me, obviously, was the one in London, where we have two political celebrities running for mayor, where there was Ken Livingstone was the Labour candidate, Boris Johnson, this very blonde mop-haired fellow, was the Tory, and they were both running the previous election, so it's a repeat of the previous election where Boris Johnson won, and Ken Livingstone this time, he's probably in his 70s, I think, he was getting a bit too old, but I guess
with the old guy.
Well, no, it's the old guy was already out last time, and it's like he didn't get the message, so let's make sure he doesn't win again. The funny thing for the election for me was how underwhelmed everyone was by both of the candidates, in the sense that Boris Johnson, all he seemed to have done in the last few years is to put public bikes in, which are basically a light version of what you got in France. Paris was definitely one of the first big ones, and it was a very much watered-down version of what happened in Paris. I think Paris started with 14,000 bikes, and London, which is the same size, started with about 6,000. Mm. The other thing he did was he made a huge fuss about, I'm sure people around the world know the iconic Route Master is the...
Hello?
Oh, what a horrible moment.
Yeah, it's terrible. I really wanted to know what everyone knew.
I think the British government finally stepped in and shut down Kerwin. He was about to say something too controversial. I was just about to agree with Kerwin. I guess Patrick, you'll want to go back and edit out this.
Oh, it's fine. Don't worry. We'll. You know, this is a family show. I mean, it's an easy going, not very strict show. Yeah, okay. Well, Kerwin doesn't seem to be coming back. We'll wait for him. But in the meantime, let's move on to Randy. You wanted to talk about a subject which is dear to my heart. and I'm curious where you're making it your full local story.
Because I live close to Hollywood.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
You know, I mean, relative to the rest of the world, I live close to Hollywood.
So the month
of May was the release of The Avengers, the film that everyone expected to be a large film, a film that you know did well at the box office, that drew large crowds. But I don't think anyone I heard or read expected that this movie would be the biggest film of all time.
It's really
phenomenal. It's definitely on pace. As far as its first week and weeks go, yes.
Interesting. I certainly contributed to that because I didn't really think I was going to love it. I mean, I was hoping I was going to love it, but I didn't know. And I've seen it 3 times, so I really liked it in the end.
As of yesterday, in the United States, The Avengers has grossed more than $500 million.
Jesus. Well, that's Joss Whedon. That's Joss Whedon for you. He is...
No, it isn't.
I couldn't agree more. I love Joss Whedon, and I think this is amazing.
Yes.
But I haven't seen the movie yet.
What?
And I very much look forward to it. I just need a babysitter. Anyone mind coming over?
Oh, we can hear Kerwin again. Yeah.
Oh, he's back.
He can?
Yes.
Hello.
Amazing.
I'm back.
Yay.
What was I talking about? I think I was just, you know, praising the Conservative government and Boris Johnson and long may they reign, right? Right? That's
yes,
what I was
right,
saying,
exactly.
Wasn't it?
I was going to agree with you and say that, you know, Ken Livingstone has done something crazy in that there are only two minor politicians in England that get named regularly on this side of the Atlantic, and that's Ken Livingstone and Anne Whittacombe. And I am amazed that someone can break that barrier when they do. So he must be truly crazy.
Well, I'm going to tell you, we don't really have any. We didn't really have any reporting on the local elections, so there we don't care about the UK. And we've moved on to superheroes.
Okay. That's right.
Kerwin, have you seen The Avengers?
I could hardly have been aware that the movie was coming out. Tell me about it. These Avengers.
What did they do? I'm not going to tell you about it because we've discussed it at length in the Movielicious, so I will invite any person interested in Nicole Spaggs, Terpster, and mine assessment of The Avengers to go listen to that show. But I will say, I will tell Randy that I believe it is indeed Joss Whedon's work, and the reason why it is so successful is Joss Whedon, which I think you were disagreeing with.
I was disagreeing with setting the surprise of success against Joss Whedon. It is a huge surprise that
yes.
He has been successful here.
And the thing is, I agree with that, but I think the movie would have been somewhat successful anyway, but the way Whedon managed to make it funny and not boring and action-packed and so well-balanced as it is, you know, all of these things at the same time without ever having a period of a moment of downtime in a 2.5-hour movie is, you know, Joss Whedon's credit. And had he not been the director on this movie, I think it would have been a lot more akin to maybe Iron Man or, you know, the other Marvel movies, which are okay, they're fun, but they're not really cool, you know, movies that you want to see a couple of times. This one you do. And I think that's
I will be the first to say that when this film was announced, and we're talking about back when Jon Favreau had just made the first Iron Man film, and that was such a good movie, I said, gosh, I hope they let Jon Favreau make Avengers.
Yeah.
I know they're going to have some other directors and filmmakers in on all of the films that led up to it, but I really, really hoped it was Jon Favreau. And when I heard Joss Whedon, I thought, well, there's an interesting experiment. I wonder just how wrong that will go. And I'm with you. I agree. It's great. It's wonderful and everything. But it was really hard to expect it to be, you know, the biggest second weekend of all time and that sort of thing.
No, I agree. I didn't expect it to go so well. It's just that, you know, seeing it now, I think that knowing what the movie is, I understand that it's Joss Whedon's work that made it like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that when they said it's Joss Whedon, I didn't think, oh, it's going to be super awesome and it's going to be what it actually is. I thought, you know, seeing it now, I don't think anyone, I really see Joss Whedon's influence and work in it. And Kerwin and Maria have not seen it, so,
I will.
Okay,
absolutely.
Okay. But it's been making people have been pretty excited about it in France. And it's been working very well. It's been, you know, in the top box office spots. Is it the case also in Sweden and the UK?
Again, I think I'm the wrong person to ask.
I'm
sure I'll catch some version of it or another in Nigeria.
Well, I will say, Kerwin, you're probably part of those people that I would not recommend to go see it. I think it's okay. It's, you know, it's not for you if you're not. Although, you know, Sonia, my fiance, who is absolutely not into superheroes and stuff like that, enjoyed it. So, you know.
I was, Kerwin, I hope the first thing you do when you get to Lagos is you go watch this movie somewhere.
All right. Well, there you go. You're leaving tomorrow, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So last evening in the civilized world, what are you doing? Doing the Phileas Club. It's appreciated.
That's right.
Yeah. Randy, will you take us out of here with a funny, weird kicker story in a minute max?
This is the month we found out about the AOL squatter.
There
so
what's
was that? A guy named Eric Simmons who got a position that was somewhat temporary at AOL
managed
to continue to live because when the temporary position was over, he couldn't afford to stay with friends or anything like that, managed to continue to live inside AOL's secure business, inside their facility. He fed himself with free snacks that the company gave employees. He used the gym and the showers there and the, you know, the free soaps and towels that they provided. He slept on couches and would change which couch he slept on every night in the hopes that he would not draw the ire of security. He continued to maintain his desk, and he continued to work while not getting paid. He continued to work on the project that had ended, that, you know, he was a temporary part of. And this went on and on. He was finally outed when he managed to complete something and be a part of a deal that made the company some money. And this Eric Simmons guy, just the strangest thing. Any of us who work in the corporate world can imagine it, but can't believe it. Cannot believe that there could be a guy at the office who's actually living there.
Please tell me they gave him a job. Okay, you're not.
I don't think so. I don't think they
job.
Did. I really, I read the story. I followed it a little bit. It was discussed online. I don't think there was a job offer from
terrible.
It.
Oh, but I hope he wasn't penalized at least.
It would have been, well, I don't know how, well, they could file a suit or something, but it would be such a
huge PR win.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, well, we realized he's a valuable guy, and it would be such a PR win. Why wouldn't they give him a job?
Maria, there actually was one little penalty I read about. One night while he was living there, this was back 6 months ago, apparently a security guard noticed him sleeping on a couch and kicked him out. And took his, and he had a badge, and the security guard took his badge, and I think that the story was he took his snacks too or something, and all he did was hang around outside until another worker came in and followed them through the door and went right back about his routine.
Did you say how long this was going on for?
I don't think he ever
a couple of months, was it?
Yeah, I don't think he specified something other than a period of months.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, if ever, you know, you get fired from the company you're working at, dear listener, you know what the alternatives are. All right. I think that is going to be it for the month. Thank you very much, guys, for hanging out with me while I'm in my parents' basement. Do you want to tell us how we can follow your adventures in the coming weeks? For, well, Kerwin mainly, since you're going to be traveling in all these exotic places.
That's right. So everyone can find me on the Global Urbanists, which is simply globalurbanist.com or at Global Urbanist on Twitter.
Excellent. Thank you. Maria, where can people follow the incredible adventures of your multiple pregnancies on the web?
There are more to me than pregnancies, Patrick, I must say. But
really, Randy
really
said it.
Really bad, you know, posting on social networks lately. But you can find me on Google Plus, of course. And on Google Plus, I'm Maria Moore. And once again, I have to warn people not to Google that. Those, yeah,
your name,
and not to confuse me with some kind of naked lady. I'm the one with clothes on.
You're the one with clothes on. Okay. Excellent. Randy, what about you?
Twitter.com/RandyDeluxe.
That hasn't changed, and that voice is music to my ears. For me, it's not Patrick or Patrick Beja, pretty much everywhere. And that is going to be it. We will be back in a month with hopefully a show that will be just as much fun as this one, because I had a very good time. I hope you, dear listener, had a very good time as well, and I hope you will be back in a month for the next show. Until then, we will talk to you soon. That doesn't make sense. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
About this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.